Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Overruling Nevada v. Hall edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On May 13, 2019, the Supreme Court decided Franchise Tax Board of California v. Hyatt, a case considering whether states maintain sovereign immunity from private suits in the courts of other states. In the 1990s, Gilbert Hyatt moved from California to Nevada. Following an investigation and audit, however, the Franchise Tax Board of California, FTB, claimed that he had misstated the date of his move and therefore owed California millions in unpaid taxes, penalties, and interest. Hyatt then brought a tort suit against FTB, which is a California state agency, in Nevada state court, and won a jury verdict of nearly $500 million. Although the Nevada Supreme Court set aside much of the award on appeal, it nevertheless affirmed an award of $1 million for fraud, even though a Nevada statute would have capped such damages in a similar suit against Nevada officials at $50,000. Nevada's interest in providing adequate redress to its own citizens, the court concluded, superseded the application of any statutory cap for California's benefit. In 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that judgment, concluding that the Constitution's Full Faith and Credit Clause required Nevada courts to grant the FTB the same level of immunity that Nevada agencies enjoy. The court divided equally, however, on whether to overrule its 1979 precedent, Nevada v. Hall, which holds that the Constitution does not bar private suits against a state in the courts of another state. By statute, the court was therefore required to affirm the jurisdiction of the Nevada Supreme Court. On remand, that court instructed the trial court to enter damages against FTB in accord with the statutory cap for Nevada agencies. Thereafter, the U.S. Supreme Court again granted certiorari to reconsider Nevada v. Hall. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Nevada Supreme Court and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court overruled Nevada v. Hall, holding that states retain their sovereign immunity from private suits brought in courts of other states. Justice Thomas's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Justice Breyer filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined. And now, to discuss the case, we have Stephen Sachs, Professor of Law at Duke University.
Franchise Tax Board v. Hyatt, or FTB, is a major ruling on sovereign immunity, a significant decision for structural constitutional interpretation, and an interesting signal of where the current court might be going in terms of overruling its past precedent. The case asked whether the 50 states have a constitutional sovereign immunity in each other's courts. That is, can a private person like Gilbert Hyatt sue the Franchise Tax Board of California, the state's equivalent to the IRS, and make them show up in a Nevada court? 40 years ago, in a case called Nevada v. Hall, the Supreme Court said, yes, he can. Earlier this month, though, in FTB, the Supreme Court overruled Hall and said, no, he can't. Now, that outcome was somewhat expected. Hall seemed like an outlier from the court's modern sovereign immunity case law, and state court sovereign immunity doctrine isn't exactly headline news. But how the court got there involved some unusually atextual moves from the otherwise textually inclined five-justice majority. And its decision to overrule Hall openly was, at least to Justice Breyer in dissent, a potential sign of what it might do in more controversial cases. Now, this was actually the third time that this case between Hyatt and the Franchise Tax Board had reached the court. It arose out of a tax dispute between Hyatt, who's an inventor, and the state of California. Hyatt moved from California to Nevada in the early 1990s, but the parties are still arguing in a separate proceeding about when he moved. California has a large income tax and Nevada doesn't, so the timing mattered for how much of his income was subject to California taxes. According to Hyatt, the board sent agents into Nevada who allegedly committed various torts, looking in his windows, going through his garbage, revealing private facts about him to third parties, and so on. In 1998, he sued the board over these torts in a Nevada state court. He won and was awarded almost $500 million in damages. Since then, the judgment has been cut down a good deal, most recently when the case last went up to the Supreme Court in 2016. During that round, the court split 4-4 on the sovereign immunity issue after the death of the late Justice Scalia. So the parties were still fighting over whether the board has to pay the judgment at all, or whether, as an arm of the state of California, the board had sovereign immunity to Hyatt's suit in Nevada court. Now, what makes the issue confusing is that California's claim to immunity doesn't involve any particular portion of the constitutional text. In state diversity suits, suits that are brought in federal court against a sovereign state by an alien or an out-of-state citizen, the court can cite the 11th Amendment. That amendment limits the judicial power of the United States in cases like these. But by its terms, the 11th Amendment doesn't address a suit like Hyatt's, which was filed in state court. Similarly, as Michael Ramsey has noted, the court's other sovereign immunity cases ultimately involve a reading of either Article I or Article III. What makes FTB different is that it involves an atextual limit on state power. The founders do seem to have recognized a relatively broad form of state sovereign immunity as a matter of common law and the law of nations. When the Supreme Court ruled in Chisholm versus Georgia that this immunity had been limited by Article III's language about state diversity suits, that decision was harshly criticized. As Caleb Nelson has pointed out in an excellent article on sovereign immunity as a doctrine of personal jurisdiction, the view of the Chisholm majority was actually a minority view at the time. It was opposed to the arguments of Madison and Hamilton and Marshall during the ratification debates, to those of Justice Iredell in his notes on the constitutional issues in Chisholm, and many other contemporary commentators who thought that Article III had mostly left state sovereign immunity alone. To Madison, simply creating a head of subject matter jurisdiction didn't automatically eliminate all the other barriers to suit, like alienage or couverture laws, and the same was true of sovereign immunity. By ratifying Article III, the states might have implicitly consented to certain kinds of suits brought by the United States or by each other, but not necessarily to suits brought by private citizens. And indeed, the Swift proposal on ratification of the 11th Amendment is at least some evidence that the view of the Chisholm majority was not widely shared. So when the question was posed 100 years later in Hans versus Louisiana, whether a citizen could sue his own state under federal law, the court said no. Article III's federal question jurisdiction had also left the law of sovereign immunity as it had previously stood. The common law doctrine of immunity might not have been expressed in the text, but the issue for the court was how to read Article III, which was in the text. Simply creating a head of jurisdiction for federal question cases, the court held, didn't strip the states of whatever immunity they had had before. Fast forward another 100 years, and the court holds in Seminole Tribe that this common law immunity couldn't be abrogated by Congress as part of its power to regulate interstate commerce. There, too, the issue was how to read a particular piece of text, the Commerce and the Necessary and Proper Clauses of Article I. If those clauses didn't confer a power to abrogate state sovereign immunity, then the common law immunity would stay intact. And most recently, in Alden versus Maine, the court held that Congress can't force states to open their own courts to certain suits against the sovereign. And that, too, was ultimately an Article I holding. If Congress doesn't have enumerated power to abrogate sovereign immunity for this purpose in federal courts, then it certainly lacks power to do the same thing in state courts. All of this, though, left open the question whether a state could abrogate this immunity. Now, 40 years ago in Nevada versus Hall, the court said that they could. Neither Article I nor Article III nor the 11th Amendment had anything to do with a state's regulation of its own courts. And as Justice Breyer pointed out in his dissent in FTB, independent nations in their own courts had at the founding the raw power to abrogate each other's immunity if they so chose. And the 10th Amendment reserved to the states and the people all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. So the court argued in Nevada versus Hall, if the Constitution doesn't actually say anything about other states' immunity, there's nothing to stop a Nevada court from dragging California in if it wants to. In FTB, the court, per Justice Thomas, rejected Hall's approach and overruled the decision. The court agreed that the states, after independence, held the status of independent sovereigns. It advanced an argument, once made by Michael Rappaport, that the Constitution's use of the word states showed that they retained certain aspects of their sovereignty. But the court argued the Constitution hadn't left sister state immunity up to the kind of international comity that would apply among sovereign nations. And to that end, it made two structural arguments. First, the court argued that the Constitution had affirmatively altered the relationships between the states, citing numerous provisions that reflect this reality. For example, while independent nations could respond to a violation of their immunity with a variety of tools. Article 1 forbids the states to wage war or to enter treaties or to place embargoes on each other and so on. And Article 4's full faith and credit clause does impose some obligations with respect to other states' judgments. The problem with this structural argument, though, is that it may prove too much. Conservatives have famously criticized cases like Griswold versus Connecticut, which found a right to privacy in the possession of contraceptives by identifying a variety of other privacy rights protected by the Constitution, such as the Fourth Amendment protection against searches and seizures, the Third Amendment protection against quartering soldiers, and so on. However, the criticism goes, the existence of other privacy rights doesn't necessarily entail the existence of this one. In the same way, the existence of other limits on the powers of independent states doesn't entail the existence of this limit or any affirmative constitutional guarantee of sister state sovereign immunity. In fact, you can imagine the very same kind of argument being lodged against state sovereign immunity in general. States can't wage war or enter treaties, so perhaps they no longer have the kind of sovereignty that might lend itself to sovereign immunity. That argument is flawed in part because it overlooks doctrinal distinctions that would have been recognized at the founding. But the same is true here. States' immunities at the founding were the product of the common law and the law of nations, and not of any affirmative constitutional guarantee. The court's second structural argument addressed the states as equal sovereigns. In many different cases, the state's membership in a single federal system is thought to limit their independent authority. So no one state can apply its own law to a border dispute or an interstate water case or the interpretation of an interstate compact. So if Nevada can't conclude California's claims to water rights, let's say, then how can a Nevada court decide how much money California has to owe to Gilbert Hyatt? As the court in FDB explained, there are many historical doctrines, like judicial review or executive privilege, which find no direct expression in the text, but which are understood to be embedded in the constitutional structure. One problem with this argument, however, is that it overlooks other founding-era sources for limits like these on state authority. Again, the rules for state borders or water rights, like the rules on sovereign immunity, didn't come from anything in federal law, but from the common law and the law of nations. In the same way, our rules about judicial review or executive privilege derive from traditional doctrines about limited grants of authority, not from sort of invisible ink rules that were thought to be hidden somewhere in the Constitution. As Nelson's article points out, it's a fundamental mistake to quote prominent framers without investigating the legal basis for their conclusions. The fact that framers thought that there was a rule of immunity doesn't show that they thought that it was a constitutional rule. As I argued in an amicus brief with William Bode, people at the founding did recognize similar limits on the judicial authority of state courts. But these limits, again, didn't come from federal law, but from the common law and the law of nations. The remedy for violating them wasn't a federal question appeal, but the fact that every other court, state or federal, would ignore a judgment that had been issued without authority according to the international rules. So if a state tried to apply its own law to a border dispute, everyone else will just ignore them. And if Nevada tries to boss California around in a private lawsuit, everyone else might ignore them too, rendering any judgment in the case unenforceable. Now, the court in FDB seemed instead to constitutionalize rules like these, to treat them as part of the constitutional structure and therefore as federal law, which raises questions about which other topics in the conflict of laws or in interstate disputes might be seen as constitutional in nature. The last issue faced by the court was what to do with Nevada versus Hall, and in less than two pages, the court quickly disposed of it. It noted that stare decisis is at its weakest in constitutional cases, and it identified four relevant factors for overturning precedent: the quality of the prior case's reasoning, its consistency with related decisions, any subsequent legal developments, and any later reliance on the decision. The first three factors to the court were easily met. It had already concluded that Hall was quite wrong, and Hall arguably stood as an exception to the rest of its case law on sovereign immunity, making consistency and subsequent legal developments point in favor of overruling. The reliance factor, too, was quickly answered. Although individual parties might have relied on Hall when suing states, the court wrote, this sort of reliance would always be present whenever a case was reconsidered. Now, in dissent, Justice Breyer emphasized a further kind of reliance, the reliance of lawyers and their clients on stable rules of law. He described the majority's approach to stare decisis as dangerous, and noted that, quote, today's decision can only cause one to wonder which cases the court will overrule next. Many commentators have seen this as a not very implicit reference to more controversial cases such as Roe or Casey. And given the politics of modern stare decisis doctrine, it seems likely that that was the intended reference. But as noted above, the court was more willing to overrule Hall in part because it already had a good deal of case law on the topic, much of which pointed the other way. So it seems relatively difficult to draw any direct inference from what happens in a sleeper case like FTB to what will actually happen in one of the more truly controversial areas of the court's docket. With respect to sovereign immunity, this is a major decision. With respect to stare decisis in general, it seems more atmospheric than anything else.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.